The Economist's Hour, False Prophets, Free Markets, and the Fracture of Society. Written by Benjamin Applebaum. Read by Dan Bittner. For my parents, my partner, and my children. Introduction. When modern science appeared, medieval Christianity was a complete, comprehensive system which explained both man and the universe. It was the basis for government, the inspiration for knowledge and art, the arbiter of war as of peace, and the power behind the production and distribution of wealth, none of which was sufficient to prevent its downfall. Michel Houellebecq, The Elementary Particles, 1998. I can calculate the motions of the heavenly bodies, but not the madness of people. Isaac Newton, 1720. In the early 1950s, a young economist named Paul Volcker worked as a human calculator in an office deep inside the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. He crunched numbers for the people who made decisions, and he told his wife that he saw little chance of ever moving up. The central bank's leadership included bankers, lawyers, and an Iowa hog farmer, but not a single economist. The Fed's chairman, William McChesney Martin, was a stockbroker with a low opinion of the species. "We have 50 econometricians working for us at the Fed," he told a visitor. "They are all located in the basement of this building, and there is a reason why they are there." They were in the building, he said, because they asked good questions. They were in the basement, he continued, because they don't know their own limitations, and they have a far greater sense of confidence in their analysis than I have found to be warranted. Martin's distaste for economists was widely shared among the mid-century American elite. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt privately dismissed John Maynard Keynes, the most important economist of his generation, as an impractical mathematician. President Dwight D. Eisenhower, in his farewell address, urged Americans to keep technocrats from power, warning that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite. Congress took testimony from economists, but as a rule, it did not take that testimony very seriously. Economics was viewed generally among top policymakers, especially on Capitol Hill, as an esoteric field which could not bridge the gap to meet specific problems of concern. An aide to Wisconsin Senator William Proxmire, a leading Democrat on domestic policy, wrote in the early 1960s. When C. Douglas Dillon, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, commissioned two studies in 1963 of potential improvements to the international monetary system, he pointedly declined to consult academic economists. Another official explained their advice was practically useless to those in charge of decision-making. That same year, the Supreme Court upheld the government's decision to prevent the merger of two Philadelphia banks, despite evidence the merger would produce economic benefits. The court described the economic evidence as irrelevant. But a revolution was coming. Economists who believed in the power and the glory of markets were on the cusp of a rise to influence that transformed the business of government, the conduct of business, and, as a result, the patterns of everyday life. As the quarter century of growth that followed World War II sputtered to a close in the 1970s, these economists persuaded political leaders to reduce government's role in the economy, to trust that markets would deliver better results than bureaucrats. Economics is often called the dismal science for its insistence that choices must be made because resources are limited. But the real message of economics, the reason for its popularity, is the tantalizing promise that it can help humankind to loosen those surly bonds of scarcity. Alchemists promised to make gold from lead. Economists said they could do it ex nihilo, through better policymaking. In the four decades between 1969 and 2008, a period I call the Economist's Hour, borrowing a phrase from the historian Thomas McCraw,